The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Jules Pieri. Jules is co-founder and CEO of the product launch platform, The Grommet. Jules started her career as an industrial designer for technology companies and was subsequently a senior executive with such brands as Keds, StrideRight, and PlaySchool. The Grommet is her third startup, following roles as VP at Design Continuum and president of Zigs.com. She completed her undergraduate degree at the University of Michigan, and people tell her she is the first designer to graduate from Harvard Business School, where she is currently an entrepreneur in residence. Jules is named one of Fortune's most powerful women entrepreneurs in 2013. In June of 2014, Jules was invited to the White House Maker Fair to launch the Grommet wholesale platform, connecting makers with Main Street retailers. She writes a personal blog at julesthegrommet.com and the CEO Unplugged column on Inc.com. She has a new book. It's called How We Make Stuff Now. Jules Pieri, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly.
I want to start our conversation by setting some context for the world we're living in today when it comes to products and product makers. You write in the introduction to your book that, quote, dysfunction in retail threatens to squash product innovation nearly at birth, end quote. How is that so?
Well, it's two things. One is innovation's kind of buried on the large marketplaces like Amazon. I mean, think about it. If you don't know something exists, you're not looking for it.
Right.
And you are more likely to trip on it at physical retail or in a more curated experience. But retailers have gotten very big, very conservative, and have become almost like historians, just repeating last year with a little twist. So they're not taking the risks on small products and small companies, and that's where innovation comes from.
Right. So explain for our audience that hasn't been to your site what exactly the Grommet is.
So we look at 300 products a week to launch six. And we tell the story of those six with a video and dive in deep to let you know its origins, the values of the product, and the company. And you might think of us as operating like a de-risked Kickstarter in a sort of vast space between, you know, commodities that you might find on Amazon or handcraft on Etsy. These are manufactured products. We launch Swell water bottles, Fitbit, SodaStream, Otter, OtterBox, Simply Safe, a lot of products that now are household names.
You did the Squatty Potty, right?
You did. You found that one. That's fantastic. I will never forget the day my co-founder came back from having discovered that was a tiny family company.
Uh-huh.
Nobody had heard of it. They hadn't done their cool viral videos yet. And, you know, frankly, half of us were laughing at her for being so excited about it. But just like everything else, we tested it and it worked.
Yeah, that video has been watched like 34 million times, probably more by
exactly.
Now.
Exactly. Yeah, they were really smart. It's unusual for a little company to have the ability to pull that off, but they did. I'm so proud of them.
It's so interesting because it's funny. I'm reading a book for an upcoming podcast with Ken Aletta. It's called Frenemies, which is about how the media landscape has changed, right? With advertising and Google and Amazon. And this is how the world is changing. So, you know, yes, in your little corner, but your corner is also much like the rest of the world, which is, you know, this tension between the sort of niche and unique and the mass. And I don't know that we've, I mean, clearly more disruption is going to happen. We certainly haven't found a balance yet.
Well, what I'm excited about, though, is we're seeing almost the revenge of the little guys, because the big guys have been asleep at the switch in many ways in the large brands. They have been under pressure at retail. It's become a discount environment, which is not very friendly to innovation. So if you look at grocery, just food alone, since in the last 6 years, little brands have eaten up 19% market share. And that kind of blows my mind, because these are brands you never heard of, and this is food. You're going to put it in your mouth. Mm-hmm. Yet we have a propensity, we're showing a propensity to trust products from unknown companies over the name brands. And I actually think that trust is warranted. I'm living at the coal face of this, watching these companies develop legitimately better products. In the case of food, they're responding to lifestyle or health concerns, and they're more modern. They're paying attention instead of just marketing the same old stuff.
Well, and this is the problem with scale, right? So the large brands, they're not necessarily like spending a ton of money on R&D. They tend to buy it, right? They go out and they buy innovation, and then that doesn't make them an innovative company. In fact, they haven't flexed that muscle whatsoever.
That's actually a fairly new phenomenon, though, I would say. I mean, some people are saying that M&A, mergers and acquisitions, are the new R&D. And you see it in the R&D numbers. A company like Pepsi is spending 1% on R&D, and Google is spending 15%. Mm-hmm. So they really are not innovative. There is a rational reason, though, I will say, just to explain, well, why would this happen? It just seems kind of dumb, and these are not stupid people. It's because they kind of think of new products as having kind of a zero-sum game. If they release a new product, they consider it cannibalizing something they already have producing at retail. Mm-hmm. And so they create these really high goals for new products in larger companies. I've heard a story from one entrepreneur who had a company called Fresh Monster. The founders were at Unilever and proposed this product line there. It's a line of inexpensive organic personal care products for children. Unilever understood the need. It didn't exist. Nobody filled the need. And yet these two potential founders were told that they needed to deliver $100 million in revenue in year one in order to justify the risk at Unilever. Hmm. And that may have been rational on Unilever's part, but an entrepreneur, as these two women did, can take their show on the road, and they're very happy with $1 million year one.
Right.
That's a success, right?
Yep.
And that's where innovation gets born.
Yeah. And your second chapter covers this. So when I'm asked to describe theatrical improvisation, which I've trafficked in for over 30 years, I often say that it's a practice in getting groups of people to make something out of nothing. And that's the second chapter of your book. You know, this idea of where ideas come from, and that you say they need to be fueled by great inputs.
Yes. So, in the case of the entrepreneur or the potential founder doing research, like, you know, the famous way Steve Jobs would do it would be finding people who knew stuff he didn't know. Mm-hmm. When he had a germ of an idea, he didn't think he had to be the smartest guy in the room always, but he needed to know those people. So he was fueling his creative energy. It's also, in the case of my own life, I'm a person who would rather stay home or stay in the office. But I will get on that plane, I will go to the conference, I will do the thing, because I've learned to trust that when I show up at the thing that I don't want to do, mm-hmm. I'm going to meet somebody who provokes an idea or tells me something I didn't know. Same reason why, this is going to sound so old school, I read newspapers and magazines, and it's not because I'm attached to them for some historical reason, it's quite forward-looking. When I read a newspaper or a magazine, I am forced to look at things that I wouldn't search for or necessarily trip on.
100%.
So I stick to them because I wrestle with it because I feel like some, you know, old dinosaur when I'm doing this, but I actually find it fuels ideas for me.
Well, this is the thing, right? So what we know from behavioral science is our default is to either say no or to do nothing. That's sort of kind of how we're wired. Many of us are introverts. I'm not, but my wife is. And so you have to sort of create nudges for yourself to go to those places that are maybe hard for you to go. And this is one of the things I love about our art form in improvisation, which is like it forces you to encounter and relate to other individuals, to build with them. And the great thing about that is whatever your, you know, sort of reluctance maybe to do it, once you do it, it feels good. And we know this too from the science that, you know, we wildly overestimate how awkward these new conversations are going to be. And once you kind of step into it, you make discoveries together. And that's A, where great ideas come, but even more important, that's how you build relationships.
Yeah, that makes total sense. One of the best marketing people on the Grommet team is actually a guy who spends most of his free time doing improv.
Oh.
And he schooled me on this, and we show up as a team sometimes to go heckle him when he's performing. but I can see it at work. I can see it in his performance.
Yeah, and you talk about relationship building, and you say, quote, sincere real-world networking is simply finding people whose expertise you respect and asking them to share a bit of it. It doesn't need to be more complicated than that. Networking doesn't need to be usury. It's really just sort of, you know, finding smart people and just asking for their advice, and sometimes more stuff comes out of that.
A good friend of mine describes great networkers as people who do a series of kindnesses.
Like, oh, I love that.
When they're asked, they give, right? And they don't do it for any particular reason, but then at the end of a year or some years of doing that, they have a lot of people who really care about them, who would really help them when they need it. And I found in my own life, when I was in a big corporation type career, I didn't really need that much because big companies have the resources at hand for the most part. So I was more on the constant giving side. You know, I wasn't really looking for much. And when I started a company, I actually needed a lot. I needed everything, basically, mm-hmm. You name it, from paperclips to legal services. And all those years of essentially not even thinking about it as networking, but just being helpful, really paid off. People answered the calls, answered the emails.
Yeah. Well, you know, Adam Grant's done work on that, his book Give and Take. And I mean, and yep. So he's a friend of mine. And I know, like, so many of my great relationships and even business lines I've started have been Adam saying, hey, can you take a lunch with a friend of mine? Because I think you're going to hit it off. And it doesn't, I love going into those meetings not knowing what this person does, because then you just have this opportunity to really hear and experience and build something authentic. Your chapter, the one I was sort of fascinated by was this idea around market research, because I know nothing about market research. I was very lucky to work at Second City, where audiences just kind of show up, and we create products that we didn't, because we played very small venues, we didn't have to worry about, huge market research. And you say, quote, the one thing that makes me cringe is when a new entrepreneur pursues a product or business that has no market. So talk to us about that, and what would be an example of a business that has no market?
Well, I think I think I might have shared this in the book. We saw an entrepreneur who was pursuing a perfume that makes women smell younger.
Oh, no.
Imagine trying to, I think you have to create that market. Like, women don't walk around thinking we smell old.
No.
So you got to tell it. No. I don't know a single woman in my whole life who's ever said that.
Mm-hmm.
And we think we have a lot of problems, but not that one. So suddenly you've got to create the idea of this problem in your target market's mind. You got to find those people because they're not walking around looking for you. And then you've got to convince them that this solution, which sounds a little ludicrous, it's almost like when Bic did lady pens.
Right.
Like they really, you know, like, wait a minute, you seriously telling me that I've been using a man pen and I'm compromised? It's a little like that. Like,
yeah.
You're telling me something that is just not credible to me right from the get-go.
You also talk about a common too small market. And this was very interesting because you talk about new parents. And I was like, I thought that through. I'm like, you're right. That is like, you're only a new parent for a very specific period of time. Maybe you're going to have multiple kids, but even then you're only going to be a new parent for a brief period of time. And that's got to be a very tough market to get into, at least at scale.
It is because first of all, the problems that a new parent has in every stage of a child's development, are real. So it's the opposite of the perfume. These are credible problems. People recognize the problems. People are often desperate to solve the problems. But the hard truth is children grow quickly, and those problems tend to be short-lived, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So by the time you're starting to search for a solution, the problem's ending, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you may never get that chance to search. So the market, the need may be real, but the market is too hard to find or too hard to serve.
And I think the other tough thing is, and again, I've trafficked in a lot of original work, original theatrical work. And because I had a fair amount of success, I would come up with ideas and everyone would say, that sounds great. That's the last thing you need, is like someone just to say, oh yeah, your ideas are great. You really have to seek out, if you want to do this wisely, people who are willing to disagree or tell you the hard truth.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. I see a lot of entrepreneurs who've talked to their mother, their brother, their dog. Everybody's telling them they're going to be a billionaire. And these are because these people, A, are not qualified to evaluate a business idea per se, but also they love you and they want to encourage you.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually need to get the hard, cold truth from strangers and never fall in love with your own idea until a stranger does. I particularly like how one of our makers on Gromit does her own market research. Her name's Joelle Mertz. She lives in L.A. And she goes to LAX, the airport, and buys the cheapest ticket she can find. And she walks up and down the gates with a prototype or something or a survey that she needs information on, never revealing she's the entrepreneur. She just pretends she's market research lady. People sitting at gates are a cross-section of America, right, or even international.
Sure.
And she just goes from gate to gate. People are bored. They almost are asking to talk to her as opposed to running away from her in the mall.
Mm-hmm.
And she just keeps pulling out this playbook every time she needs to talk to strangers effectively and inexpensively.
That's amazing. Okay, so you have a design background, and I really enjoyed I learned a lot reading about how you talk about design. One of the quotes that I pulled from the book was, quote, good user experience design is about removing everything that comes between the user's objective and the actual fulfillment of that objective. This feels like sort of a Buddhist idea about how to make a very commercial product, right? It's like, how much emptiness can you and blank space can you fill in? But talk to us a little bit about how that plays itself out, that idea.
Well, think about when you get in a rental car, right? And some of that removal means don't do anything that's tricky and swish just because it represents your brand. This person is just trying to turn on the heat.
Yeah.
Like, make that possible. Think about what the logical path for a stranger or a new purchaser of this car would want, would need, instead of thinking about how you want to represent your brand. Because there are parts of products that are usually quite functional, and those are especially the times when you want to strip it down to just its core essence. Certainly, one product that got away from us that we never were able to launch, but we knew would be a hit, was the Nest, the thermostat.
Mm-hmm.
And think about that. If any of your listeners have used that, you almost can't get it wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, every single tiny little twist of that dial reveals what you expect it to reveal. The icons make sense. There are only about 5 or 6 of them, not a lot of copy. It really works.
You also are big on project briefs.
Yeah.
Right. And I, like, in your experience, like, how many people are good at project briefs?
Like none.
None.
No, seriously.
Yeah.
The problem is people who are not coming up from a creative career, a creative profession, always make the mistake of thinking that they want to kind of let the creative they're going to hire, whether it's a writer or a designer or a filmmaker or anything, they want to let them, you know, they don't want to set too many boundaries. They want to let them roam free.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the worst possible thing for a creative person, somebody who's in business. They'd like to know that what problem they solve, because, or they're supposed to solve, because then they know when they've succeeded. They know what they're aiming at. And they like to know exactly what you've considered and what you haven't considered and what world you operate in. So a good brief starts with, like, why the heck are we talking about this project? Like, give me context. And obviously a little bit of background about the business. But what's the business imperative, or what's the need that really created this conversation? And then it moves into possible, kind of customer direction or markets you're attacking, and it gives direction on how to do competitive research and what you would think about. And then it would talk about, like, what is success? Like, the Fitbit itself, it probably had success criteria, like it needs to cost under $100. It needs to be convenient to carry or wear. It needs to be water resistant, if not waterproof. It needs to connect to a phone. It needs to have an app. Like, that's success criteria. But nobody said in there it needs to be a wristband, or nobody said it needs to be on your ankle, or it needs to be a clip. But you start to understand, like, the certain form factor. It has to be convenient for very active people. So that's kind of what I mean.
I had a playwriting teacher who once said, if you can't tell me what your play is in one sentence, you don't have a play. And that's been my experience at Second City, especially because we do mostly short form content. We're constantly editing and refining and being like, okay, so what is this scene about? What are the characters' objectives? And these constraints are actually, for highly creative people, very important, because the more creative you are, you're going to tend to go way outside, and you need something to pull you back in, because there's plenty of space with whatever's in front of you to do something highly creative. And it gets really murky and muddy when you go outside of that. So I really like this idea that you talk about. And I think, yes, it's good for business, but I think it is just as valid in pure sort of creative work, that you need to have a lot of thinking beforehand, very sort of clear constraints and ideas of where you're going. And then within that box, you have room to move and play.
You can see how excited a great creative person comes.
Yes.
when they have those constraints, they do their best work. It's amazing. There's kind of a parallel, actually, in pitching a startup, and it was a lesson I had to learn the hard way, in that I thought, so I'm talking about pitching for investment primarily, and your vehicle is yourself speaking and usually a PowerPoint. And I thought, when I went into those pitches, that I needed to sound smart. Like, I needed to show that I knew a ton, because why would you put money into my company unless I did that, unless I succeeded at that? That is actually not the job. The job is a little bit back to what you said earlier about improv. It's to engage the other person, because they're going to have no interest in your ideas if they can't engage with them. Mm-hmm. And sounding smart and sort of deluging with somebody with information is not exactly a great way to engage them. Mm-hmm. So I learned this from being, actually, you mentioned I'm an entrepreneur in residence at Harvard Business School, and I have to look at a lot of pitches every time I go there. And I learned to take these kind of smart, sometimes dense pitch books and turn them into, I call them, kindergarten board books.
Yeah.
Like, literally a picture and a couple words on every slide. People think I'm exaggerating. I really am not. If you get somebody to understand you from slide 2 to slide 3 to slide 4, and you get them asking the questions that allow you to actually show your knowledge and get to the place you thought you needed to be at, that's so much better. But if you lose them at slide 3, say, they're not going to decide that they're stupid. You know, the investor's not going to decide that they themselves are stupid. They're just going to sort of check out and maybe decide you're not so good at pitching.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really different headset to engage rather than pitch.
Right. Well, and again, one of the things that you're so good at the Grommet is sort of the storytelling of these various products. And I found myself, and the book's great because you have a bunch of these sort of like case studies. One of the ones that I was really interested in was, I think you pronounce it, the buttery. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Right. So my mom left butter out on the counter all the time. She didn't refrigerate it. And none of my friends could understand how that was okay. And I'm like, she's from the Boston area. I don't know. But everyone else I know put their butter in the fridge. So talk to us about the buttery.
So kind of similarly, the entrepreneur for that product saw somebody with butter on their counter and had almost like that, kind of a gas reaction as well. And the friend said pretty much what you said. And so the entrepreneur set out to sort of find out if this was true, and kind of a hidden gem in a lot of our communities, that there are food science labs, some of them are government run, and we have access to them, and there are universities. So she set out to figure out if this was true, and it turned out to be true, that butter could sit out for 3 weeks before any, sort of random possibly bad thing happen, and even that was like some tiny particulate. So she decided 3 weeks was the limit, and that's how she would market the buttery.
So wild. All right. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about is you write about intellectual property. And so my experience, especially in the world of improvisation, because improvisation can't be owned when someone's just making up a scene. You can turn that into writing and product that can be owned either by the people who did it or by, in the case of the people at Second City owns a lot of that stuff. But I found at different times over the course of my career, you know, you'd run across someone who'd be like, I want to save my best ideas, or I don't want to share this character because I'm afraid someone's going to steal it, or whatever. And when you're innovating, you really do have to take that risk of sharing your great idea, because just holding on to it, I don't think that's ever going to get you anywhere.
It's such a rookie error. I see so many, you know, completely inexperienced entrepreneurs who don't want to share the idea, even go so far as to have, you know, someone like me try to get me to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Mm-hmm. And it's such a rookie error because the marginal risk of me running off with their idea or anyone wanting to throw their life over for your idea, it's so just human nature, not likely. It's hard to be that excited about somebody else's idea. So it's always worth it to take that risk. And, of course, you do need to protect your intellectual property before you go out to market, because you are talking about actual businesses who might have motivation to steal your stuff, especially these days, because 25% of what's sold on Amazon is coming straight from a Chinese factory, and they're all just copying and counterfeiting products. So there are real risks, but the risks do not exist at the research, conversation,
right,
prototype level.
Yeah, and getting caught up in the idea of trademarks and patents, again, yes, eventually that makes sense, but you write in the book, quote, a patent is only as valuable as your resources to defend it. And if you're just making something up now, you don't have the money to defend your patent, go after all these sort of folks. So, you know, that's not something, especially at the start, that you need to worry about.
Not at the very start. It is something that if you can get it, you should get it. And some people pursue that route, you know, kind of DIY, and some people use lawyers. But again, the timing matters. It's not, why would you put that expense into the business before you know if you even have a market, if you even produce this product profitably, or it's a good idea? So it is a timing thing.
Okay, in a moment, I'm going to ask you, as we ask all our guests, for a yes and story, a time in your life when maybe you normally would have said no, but instead said yes and. But before you do that, you do talk about prototyping. And this is something in your field that is very akin to my field. Because in improvisation, what you're really doing is prototyping your characters and lines and ideas over and over again in front of audiences to get to something that works. And my scientist friends tell me the only way you get to as close as we can get to truth or evidence is by testing it over and over and over again. And that's the same thing in your field, right?
Yes, this is something from my design experience, in that when you come up as a designer, you're taught to sort of conceptualize as rapidly as possible, and that's both at the idea phase, but also at the prototype. And prototype in the professional world is as low fidelity as possible.
Right.
Amateurs might jump right to a 3D, you know, printed object or a CAD drawing. And here's the problem with that. The minute you get into the execution of something refined and possibly expensive, you get very committed to that idea, right? Mm-hmm. You're just trying to execute one idea. You want to stay in that sort of loose, free-form experimentation mode as far as you can, so that in the case of physical products, means even like paper or foam or clay or cardboard or foam core, these are very inexpensive materials that don't look beautiful when you're working with them, but you learn so much, or you can communicate your idea so much better than if you sketch it or you try to describe it with words. So that's that. You stay there as long as possible to make sure that you're on the right track before you start incurring real expense or really, you know, investing in the business in any way.
Yeah, that's always been our argument with our friends in Hollywood is, you know, you're commissioning in sort of an older model, but it still exists. You know, you'll pay these writers hundreds of thousands of dollars to create these new scripts that may work or may not work, when you could spend way less to have a group of improvisers play around with the ideas, see what they look like in front of you, see what kind of sticks and makes you laugh, and then from there go into a potentially a writing process. And it's the way a lot of art gets made elsewhere, but somehow these systems got created. And I think it's similar to retail, where you somehow these sort of, you know, big retailers got so big that they forgot how all this stuff started when it was like little and we were all playing in a garage.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, independent retail, small retailers are still the lifeblood of innovation, but the big guys really, really wait until it's proven out, kind of like that, you know, wasting all that money and all those scripts.
Yep. Okay, do you have a yes and story for us? So in the parlance of improvisation, you know, you get nowhere when you say no, and you can't just stop and say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. It's sort of the golden rule of improvisation. So has something come along with you in your life where normally you would say no, but instead you said yes and?
I think so. My first job right out of business school, I joined a company that was a startup. It's called Continuum, an innovation consultancy. And it was wobbly. It almost went out of business within 2 months of my joining. And I was the only person in my class to join a startup. So I was already doing something really weird. 2 months into it, I was laid off along with everybody else who had been recently hired. And I guess the yes and part was, I actually agreed with the decision. And the yes and is, yes, I would totally lay me off because I'm just doing marketing. This business needs sales. Mm-hmm. And I will do that. So right. I proposed a 3-day-a-week schedule because I wasn't sure if I was going to need to also look for a job. I proposed being paid $1,000 a month only and a commission plan on top of that. I just made it up. I'm talking about real-life improv.
Yeah.
I wrote down on paper my proposal and brought in the two founders when I was supposed to be packing up my office, mm-hmm. and said, look, I'm willing to do this. And yeah, we kind of had a handshake on it. I ended up doing that for 5 years. I was never paid salary-wise more than $12,000, but I did fine on commission.
That is a total yes and moment, because because you know, you're yesing the ultimate no necessarily, right? Like, I'm out, but you find the and. You know, Dan Pink talked about this when we talked to him, which is he was, because he has a past as a lawyer, and he was advising a client in a negotiation. He's like, there's a yes and an and in there, and you just need to find it. Some place where you can agree and then build from that agreement. And that's, I think so often we see the no, and we just go with that. And again, we're wired to do that. That is how our brains work. So that's wonderful that you found this opportunity to, in a kind of a dark period, to then, you know, carve out a niche for yourself, and then real. And that's also an entrepreneurial thing you did as well.
Yes, it definitely was, and that actually stood me in good stead for the rest of my career, because I really, you know, ate what I could kill, right?
Yeah.
It's so important to so many careers to be comfortable with sales or putting yourself out there.
The book is called How We Make Stuff Now. Jules Pierre, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, Kelly. Glad to be here.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Soul, screaming atop survives. Survive.